This podcast was recorded Thursday, May 28th at 10:30 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like we'll ban the ban on plastic bag bans.
Maybe we can use them as masks. Yeah, it's the issue that just keeps getting recycled. Let's talk Ohio politics.
This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and those snollygosters who can really turn even the most simple things political. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson, having some fun at the latest Republican-backed effort to outlaw local bans on single-use plastic bags. This time they are saying it's about being sanitary, since we shouldn't be reusing grocery bags during a pandemic, and we don't wear our masks either. I do, but some don't.
Anyway, if you're new to the podcast with the funny name, let's be honest, it is a funny name. A snollygoster is a shrewd, self-serving politician that is redundant, we know, but we like the name. So coming up in the podcast this week, an objective look at the facts surrounding mail-in voting. Imagine that.
Yes, objective facts. No need to fact check
us. Alternative facts, real facts?
No, we'll be doing the, we'll try to fact check this crazy debate over mail-in voting. Anyway, but first, the reopening of Ohio is nearly complete, with the exception of mass gatherings like concerts, movies, sporting events. Just about every service Ohioans enjoyed before the pandemic began will be available by Monday, as far as state health orders are concerned anyway.
Yep, daycare centers and day camps open Monday, and there's really not much else that cannot open at this point, except, of course, crowded events. That means things like returning to the office, the factory floor, the shopping mall, gyms, restaurants, all back operating at least as closely to normal as we will until we have a vaccine. While Governor DeWine has given the go-ahead for the gradual reopening with safety rules, of course, he's still not brimming with optimism.
As we open up this economy, people are out more. I think you're going to see more people test positive. So comfort is not where I am.
Comfort is not where he is.
He should not be selling pillows or blankets. He's not a good salesman there.
Well, the reason why he's still uncomfortable is this daily stats show the virus is still with us. Confirmed and probable cases continue to climb, but that could be because we are now testing more than we were. Deaths have climbed above 2,000 this week here in Ohio, and people are still going to the hospital with COVID-19, but that daily rate of hospital admissions has been declining.
Yeah, the hospitalizations is the one sort of silver lining in this.
And that's what they're using to...
That's the most serious cases,
to base their reopening decisions on.
Sure, and I mean, there is a... I don't think we're on the other side of the peak yet, but there is a definite plateauing that's happening. We're still seeing some increases day to day, like with deaths in particular. There are a lot of days where we've had more new confirmed days, more confirmed deaths than we did the previous day. That's obviously not heartening at all. But anecdotally speaking, my wife is an ICU nurse at the hospital in Marysville. She's been getting called off work pretty regularly. She did on Wednesday.
Called off means they don't need her.
Right, right. They'll say we don't have enough patients. And so elective surgeries have resumed. So it's not that. It's that there aren't many COVID patients, to be honest.
Yeah, you have to figure people staying home, you know, the regular stuff is also down. People aren't getting the flu.
Not as many car crashes.
If the flu is out there, not as many car crashes. Not as many accidents on the softball field or the soccer field, things like that. So there's been some other reasons why folks are staying away from urgent care and ER. You know, I get the, you know, it's funny as you, you and I have both been coming into the office pretty much every day since this started. Mm-hmm. You come in at 4 a.m. and traffic is never an issue for you. But I have seen traffic noticeably pick up on my way in. Also on the weekends, last Saturday was a normal Saturday where I live. The roads were as busy as they normally are on a nice Saturday on a holiday weekend. The home centers were crowded. Parking lots were full. I think Ohioans are venturing out. They may not be lingering at these stores, but they're certainly venturing out.
Yeah, the data from the Ohio Department of Transportation, the reality reflects the anecdotal experience you're seeing, that we did see traffic really dip down in early April, and it has, I think, pretty much since then consistently increased since the real depths of the closure, when everyone was, aside from just state shutdowns, everyone was pretty fraught. It was a really kind of a dark time in our nation, right, in late March, early April. And I since then, all traffic markers have shown that there has been an increase in traffic here in Central Ohio. The Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission says that the air quality has decreased again. So
that's good news.
That's good news for the economy. Yeah, it's certainly not good news for the birds and the fish.
People who breathe.
The people.
Without a mask.
Right.
With a mask. But you know, I think the governor is right. I mean, he fears there could be a spike if people do not, abide by or adhere to his recommendations. I went out to dinner with my wife and my son on Saturday night, local restaurant. It's walkable distance from my house. They were doing a good job. There were where there was normally four or five tables in one section of the restaurant, there were two, mm-hmm. and one was facing the wall, one was facing the window. The servers and hostess were all wearing masks. They had to wait outside. The outdoor patio had maybe three tables. They were all far apart. People are being cautious. We were being cautious. We wanted to get out. We weren't quite sure we wanted to go, but we felt comfortable eating there. So.
There obviously, as the stay-at-home order no longer exists, right now we've kind of joked that it's now a suggestion. We have not seen the protests that we saw outside of the state house. Politically, there seems to be more of a general acceptance among Republicans that it's okay to oppose the governor on this issue, mm-hmm. but there also doesn't seem to be quite the vocalness among the far right, among the Nino Vitalis, among obviously the Melissa Atkinson who lost in the primary election, the Ohio Senate candidate. There doesn't seem to be.
It's reopened.
Yeah, I mean, it's quelled the really loud naysayers. There, I mentioned Nino Vitali. He still is very active on Facebook, still constantly criticizing dictator DeWine, as he likes to talk about. I just don't sense that it's not as loud anymore.
No, the question will be: do we see that sharp spike in cases and in deaths, and what does the state do then? It's going to be really hard to shut the state down again. That there would have to be a dramatic. We hope it never happens, obviously, mm-hmm. but to have the state shut down again, I just don't see it happening.
And what would businesses do? I mean, can businesses? We've heard from restaurant owners they can't keep reopening and closing and reopening and closing. We hear from a restaurant owner in Delaware that if they close again, they're closing for good. They're not reopening the restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, restaurant business is tough enough.
Yeah. Turning now to nursing homes, also other long-term care facilities, they continue to bear the brunt of fatal COVID cases. 70% of the state's deaths are connected to nursing homes. The state will fail to meet the White House's one-time recommendation of testing every nursing home resident by this week. Governor DeWine, though, has enlisted the help of the Ohio National Guard to test nursing home staff.
When you think about that, that's incredible. Ohio National Guard, military. Yeah. These are physicians and health professionals.
Yeah, it's a medical mission.
Yeah, they're not soldiers with guns.
They won't be carrying AK-47s.
No, but the state has to send in the National Guard to test nursing home staff members.
Yeah, I don't know if have to. I guess they are. I guess maybe it makes sense for them. You know what I mean? There might be other people available, but it seems like a good mission for the National Guard.
But we need the National Guard.
Yeah, we're using the National Guard to test.
To keep residents in nursing homes safe.
You could argue it's a matter of security.
But that's the state we're in.
Yeah. They've already been handing out food at food banks.
Yeah. But nursing home residents are the most vulnerable. Let's just not make no mistake. They're usually very old, they're frail, and they live close together. What we don't know, so we know that's the case. They are the most vulnerable. What we don't know is how nursing homes are doing when it comes to preventing this infection. Anecdotally, there are nursing homes that have had no cases. But there are other nursing homes and long-term care facilities that have had more than 100 cases.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And we don't know that yet.
The state's still not releasing the names of nursing homes where deaths have happened. They're releasing them death totals by county.
Yep.
And they're also releasing nursing home names that have current infections. But the data on the state coronavirus dashboard websites, it's pretty limited. They're cases that have gone away, they're not listing them. Like there's a nursing home here in Hilliard where they had one of the first early rash of cases. They're not even listed on this site anymore because they don't have any current infections.
Yeah, it's really, we don't know. And I hope we do know because if this could, again, it could just be bad luck. That Amy Acton, the state health director from the Department of Public Health, she almost alludes to it's bad luck that a nursing home has a rash of cases, that it's not the nursing home's fault that they have a rash of cases. Well, Perhaps that's true. But why do some nursing homes have zero cases, but others have many, many?
We don't know
the answer to that question.
Her answer there would seem to be a little limited, I would think, because nursing homes that we've seen go into full lockdown, right? There are some nursing homes. There was one in Newark. My father-in-law's girlfriend works at one in Bucyrus, where she stayed there for weeks at a time and didn't leave, and no one came in. They didn't get any cases. The one in Newark didn't get any cases. So I think there is at least some anecdotal evidence that I've seen that when extreme measures are taken, it doesn't seem to get into these facilities.
And some facilities have the wherewithal, the financial resources to take those extreme measures, and others do not.
There may be nursing homes that are taking those extreme measures and they're still getting cases. So I don't want to be totally unfair, but I think the homes that they seem to have more success when they take really extreme measures.
Bottom line is, with 70% of the deaths occurring in these facilities, I think there has to be more information. We need more information as to why it's happening.
We'll be right back.
On All Sides with Ann Fisher, we cover the topics that affect life in Central Ohio, from immigration to the economy to the continuing opioid crisis.
But the reality is, if you don't save someone who's overdosed, they have no opportunity to recover.
Hear thoughtful, in-depth conversations about the issues that matter now. Subscribe to the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Sonali Goster from WOSU Public Media. Come next week, we will be exactly 5 months away from Election Day in November. Two things we think will happen. Hard to tell. Hard to know anything at this point, though, right, Mike? We will decide who will be our president for the next 4 years, and COVID-19 will still be with us.
So how can those two things coexist? How can we ask people to gather together and vote? This spring, it proved it was not easy. Here in Ohio, we canceled Election Day and went with mail-in voting. Wisconsin went forward with its Election Day, and it did not go well as far as providing equal access to voting.
So again, how can we get people to vote and keep them healthy? Most agree staying away from long lines at polling places is a good idea. And one way to do that is to make it easier for people to vote by mail.
Most agree that's the way to go. Most, of course, does not include the President of the United States, who again this week falsely disparaged mail-in voting as overwhelmingly corrupt. The President tweeted, quote, "There is no way, zero, that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. Mailboxes will be robbed, ballots will be forged, and even illegally printed out and fraudulently signed."
And again, no evidence of substantial fraud in mail-in voting. As the responsible steward of factual civil discourse of our time, Twitter pointed out with a pretty unique historic warning to users. So here to help us set the record straight is one of the nation's foremost experts on mail-in voting, Michael McDonald, a political science professor at the University of Florida. Mr. McDonald, welcome to Sonali Goster.
Great to be with you guys.
So let's set the record straight with a couple fact checks, and then we'll go deeper. President Trump says mail-in voting means mailboxes will be robbed. Has that ever happened that you know of?
Not that I know of. of course, in any human activity, there's going to be some fraud. So you can't say that there's zero fraud with mail ballots. But the cases of mail ballot fraud are isolated. They tend to happen, actually, in local and primary elections where the turnout is really low. And so you can probably try to manipulate the election with a few hundred votes. But to try to do something on the scale that the president is talking about, it just wouldn't happen. I mean, in our day of social media, someone would tweet it out somewhere that they were doing that sort of thing. It would be impossible to keep quiet. And the other important thing is that election officials are tracking signatures, and they know who's got ballots, and they're doing a lot of checks on the reliability of that to find that fraud. And so when it does occur, it's pretty hard to disguise that the fraud has occurred. And so, no, there's nothing like what the president's talking about. Yes, isolated cases of fraud, but nothing so widespread like is being implied.
Can you compare the isolated cases, as you call them, of mail-in voting fraud with other types of voting fraud, imposters at the polling place, things like that, hacking into systems?
Yeah. Of course, the irony here is that if we weren't running an all-mail ballot election or encouraging people to run elections by mail, we'd be instead having the president talk about how there's all this fraud with the in-person voting, likely. His real goal is just to undermine our confidence in our elections and our democratic processes because, quite frankly, he's behind in all the polling, and he's anticipating that he's likely going to lose. Who knows, with the Electoral College, but certainly in the national polling looks grim for him, and the Electoral College is not looking very good right now either. Still a lot of time, 5 more months, so we'll see. But I think that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to downplay the fact that he anticipates he's going to lose, and is just looking to provide some excuse to point to that why he lost when, in truth, it was just that the voters weren't going to support him.
So bottom line, is mail-in voting safe? If we had to, could we rely on it to pick the president of the United States, members of Congress, whether we should legalize marijuana here in Ohio? Do you think it's a reliable way to vote?
Yes, it is. And, it's not just me who's saying that. It's, in Ohio, it's a Republican Secretary of State who's saying that. There are responsible Republican elected officials who run elections across the country who also support mail balloting. So, I would look to the people who have a lot of experience doing this, who are in charge of running the elections. They are the experts here. They know what they're talking about.
Do you think it's politically expedient for Republicans to criticize mail-in voting and for Democrats to tout it? Do you think that there's legit political reasons behind that, that mail-in voting favors Democrats and that it does not favor Republicans?
It's a really complicated question here. If you look at ballot rejection rates in the past, you would say, well, actually, it looks like mail ballots might actually help Republicans because more Democrats who try to vote by mail have their ballots rejected, particularly younger people and persons of color. However, what we're trying to do here is something fundamentally different than a typical election where we just have some people choosing to vote by mail. Now we're encouraging lots of people to vote by mail. And there are disparate resources that you have between urban areas and rural areas. In urban areas, they've got the staff, they've got the resources to push a lot of paper through their offices, which is what you're going to need to do to run a mail ballot election. In rural areas, you may have just like one election official. In some cases, we're talking about part-time election officials, and they just don't have the same sort of resources. They have to somehow staff up. They don't even have the space to put the paper anywhere, and so it's much more challenging in rural areas. So scaling up to a large-scale mail ballot election may actually affect rural areas harder than urban areas. And then you've got on top of all of this the slowness in the mail. We know that rural areas, it takes longer for the mail to travel from a home to an election office because the mail is centrally processed in urban areas. But that in an urban area, that mail is going to run just a little bit faster. So to meet deadlines, you're going to also find some problems. And I say all this because Republicans have been really resistant. They think that, well, if we, at least some Republicans, not all, but some Republicans have been resistant to providing the support to mail balloting, especially in the U.S. Senate. And it actually is hurting Republicans because you've got these rural areas that actually need some resources in order to run their elections efficiently. The urban areas are going to be okay.
All the more reason that, here we are in the end of May to settle this thing now, 5 months out, so we can get these rural folks staffed up, get some money from Congress to change how we do the election and change. We have to change state law, change deadlines, change how we mail out absentee ballot applications and early voting ballots. Let's start with the process of mail-in voting. What are the basic safeguards that successful states have used to prevent any kind of mischief with mail-in ballots?
Well, the primary thing that states do, election officials do, is they do signature verification. So election officials have on record a signature from you, maybe with your voter registration. In the all-mail ballot states, they actually digitize every signature that comes to their office, and those signatures will be on the ballot envelopes that people are returning to election offices. So those states actually have very robust history of signatures, and they can match that signature against the signature that's on the ballot that's being returned. If that signature doesn't match up, election officials will put it aside and they will do some further investigation. And this is, again, where we start getting this sort of fraud detection. If you start seeing, like, a lot of signatures showing up that look very similar to one another and you're rejecting them all and a pile is starting to build up, that's a pattern that people pick up on pretty quickly.
Everyone's using the same purple pen.
Yeah. And you just can't request someone's ballot to be sent to your home. You can't do that either. So if you suddenly get like a bunch of ballot request forms that are saying, hey, send this ballot here, and it's the same address, again, people are going to start picking up on that from the election official side, and they're going to flag that for concern. And so that it's primarily that signature verification process. Some states have witness signatures and even notaries for the ballots, and those are being challenged in court at the moment because
that's hard.
You know, if you're social distancing by yourself, can you get a witness signature? Can you even get a notary?
Even without social distancing, I mean, to chase down a notary public to cast a ballot just seems above and beyond. Getting to how people should get their ballot. Ohio, the way it works here is you have to request. You have to apply for an early absentee mail-in ballot. The ballot is just not sent to you. And that's not going to happen here. The Republican legislature here is not going to approve just sending a ballot to every registered voter. What do you think of the process of applying to vote by mail, then getting the ballot, and then it's like a two or three-step process to get this done? Is that too much?
I think it's costly and unnecessary. That's another piece of paper that's got to move through an election office. Again, it's going to disproportionately hit these rural areas because now these election officials are going to have to manage another piece of paper. What I would recommend for everybody is it's kind of like flattening the curve with our hospitals. If you can get that ballot request in as soon as you can, that means that election officials can spend more time as we get closer to the election to manage the mail ballots themselves. But these election officials are going to be overwhelmed. This is another piece of mail that's got to go out, piece of paper. That's a postage, that's a printed envelope, and a printed piece of paper on the inside. That's costly. That's going to cost the state millions of dollars. Hey, you know, that's what you want to do in the midst of a pandemic where state budgets and local governments being hit hard is waste a couple million dollars. That's a choice that people are making. And I just don't think it's necessary, but it's going to happen because that's what's happening in Ohio and Ohio law. Other states like California has already decided that they're going to run an all-mail ballot election, join the other all-mail ballot states, and just directly send voters their ballot instead of cutting out the ballot request step. Some states have done this, like Nevada and New Jersey, for their primaries. And they may do it for their general elections as well. It could be done that you just send out your ballot directly to every registered voter, but that's not what's going to happen. And so, unfortunately, and again, I think that this is short-sighted. I think it's going to disproportionately affect the rural areas of Ohio, but that's what's going to happen. And it's going to be a lot because of perceptions that anything that reduces turnout somehow helps the Republicans, and people just aren't thinking this through all the way, that sometimes a law can disproportionately affect a certain group of people than others.
Getting to that point right there, for several minutes now, we've been largely singing the praises of mail-in voting. Are there any inherent limitations or flaws? Does it leave any particular part of the population out, or are there any other real limitations here?
Yeah, I've been alluding to some of them. One is that when that signature comes in and it doesn't match, or there's some other flaw, like, you know, sometimes people forget to sign the outside envelope, and so election officials have to go back and get that signature. In 2016, the federal government reported that over 300,000 mail ballots rejected because someone failed some part of the process. With so many people voting by mail in 2020, that number could easily be a million or more ballots that are being rejected. Election officials usually would take the time to reach back out to those voters and try and fix those problems. In the election lingo, they call it curing the ballot. there aren't going to be cures available because election officials are going to be so overwhelmed with just all the paper that's coming into their offices. They're not going to be able to help out the voters who are having problems. So we're going to have a compounded problem where people unfamiliar with the process are going to be having their ballots rejected for some reason, and election officials aren't going to be able to help them out like they might normally do in an election.
Professor McDonald, let me just one more question. I mean, I'll be honest, after listening to this conversation, I'm not confident that mail-in voting is the way to go. It sounds like it's too complicated. We have too little time to implement it. There's no money. The political will isn't there. Heck, the president of the United States is undermining it. How's this going to work if we have to rely on mail-in voting?
Well, I'm trying to lay out the problems with it so that we can take preventative action before November. And there's still time to take steps. And, you know, there are a number of things we can do. Wisconsin, when they held their election under court order, the state extended the ballot return period. That helped. That allowed nearly 80,000 ballots to be counted, and it really reduced the number of rejected ballots in the state. There were some isolated problems. The state did a post-mortem and took a look at those and are taking corrective steps for the general election. I would highly, highly encourage Ohio to do something similar. You just ran a primary. There were some problems, spots. Mostly, it worked well. I mean, so by and large, the system worked well, but there are still some problem spots. Run a postmortem, identify what those problems are, and take preventative steps for the general election. That would be the best thing to do to ensure that everybody's been going to be able to get their vote counted.
Michael McDonald, a political science professor at the University of Florida, considered one of the nation's foremost experts on mail-in voting. Professor McDonald, thanks for joining Snollygoster.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. All right, time now for our Snollygoster of the Week Award, which goes out to the most cutthroat politician or political movering of the week. And this week, the award goes to, drumroll please,
Representative John Cross, a Northwest Ohio Republican who tweeted out a video of Ohio Health Department Director Dr. Amy Acton in a conference room meeting with no mask, Mike.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. It's crazy. The woman now closely associated with masks and encouraging us all to wear masks. She was in a meeting with no face covering. What is she thinking?
I can tell you what she was thinking. It was early March when this video was taken, at the very start of the coronavirus crisis, before health experts, including the CDC, were recommending that every American wear a mask when possible.
So, out of context, imagine that. That did not stop Representative Cross from calling Acton a hypocrite and calling for her resignation, saying she does not even follow her own orders. Come on, man.
Congratulations to Representative John Cross for some real snollygostering this week. Hard to beat that one next week, I think. That's very shrewd.
Yeah. He didn't really, when he was pointed out that it was an old video, he really didn't even back down either. So,
yeah.
You know.
All right, John. Well.
That's shrewd.
I'd probably be fired for doing something like that in the news business.
Oh, yeah.
So, John, don't
reprimand it at the very least.
John, when we have any openings, don't polish up your resume. No need to send it here. And if you have a suggestion for next week, you can send it to us at snollygoster@wosu.org. Also, be sure to tell your friends about us. Tell your buddies about us. No listening parties right now, right? At least not 10 or more people. But just tell them about us.
That's right.
I know a funny podcast.
You got time to kill.
Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.